Hello, everyone, and welcome. My name is Andrew.
And I'm Rachel.
And we are Picture the Scene Podcast. We are true crime podcasts, aiming to put you, the listener, at the scene of the crime. Each week, we delve into the murky world of lesser-known crimes from the UK and Ireland, and also occasionally, we venture into renowned cases from around the globe. We are available on all the major social media channels. Just search for our name, and I'm sure you're going to find us. Also, if you'd like to and you have the capability, do drop us a rating and review as well, wherever you can. And actually, I didn't put this in the script, but I also want to just jump in and say, I may have discovered this in the past and forgotten about it, but I logged into Spotify Podcasters for the first time in like several months, and we had quite a lot of comments, people commenting on our like individual cases. So thank you, everyone. I'm sorry they didn't get published, like quite delayed. There's one or two people that posted regularly in almost all our episodes, and it's always really nice things that you're saying, so thank you very much, and thank you to that person that getting the Spinal Tap reference as well. So I'll try and keep on top of the Spotify from now on in.
Well, that's naughty of you, Andrew.
If you like us that much that you want to support us and see us carry on doing this for the foreseeable, then please do head over to Patreon, where you can support us for as little as £1 a month. We have bonus content and episodes, depending on your tier, and it really does help us carry on. To find us, there is always a link in our show notes, or you can simply Google Picture the Scene Podcast on Patreon, that's P-A-T-R-E-O-N, and you'll find us. But, as with any true crime podcast, listener discretion is always advised, and today there is no exception. We do, where possible, also release our episodes a week early for our Patreon supporters, so if you want to hear next week's episode right this second, head over to Patreon. We do have, in 2 weeks' time, we're going to have some special guests on the show, another wonderful podcast, and we're actually going to have a giveaway. I've not even told Rachel this. We're going to have a giveaway on the show of a signed true crime book. It's not going to be Patreon specific. It's going to be for all our listeners. So if you want to win yourself a signed book, the book is written about a priest and the IRA. It's really interesting. Signed, obviously, by the author. Make sure you tune in 2 weeks' time and listen to the episode.
Hot off the press, eh?
Off the press, yes. So, Rachel, how have you been?
Yeah, really good. I'm not sure whether you've caught Marnie crying in that intro there or whether listeners have clocked that I've been extremely quiet, but I think she's going to sleep now. So I'm feeling much more relaxed than I was 2 or 3 minutes ago. How about you?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm good. I'm sparkling. Thank you very much. Rachel, listeners, just so I can describe what's happening, Rachel at the moment is just bouncing back and forth, obviously trying to get Marnie to sleep. And it makes me want to yawn and close my eyes as well. So I'll try not to. Are you both ready for some true crime?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not sure how excited Marnie is about this, but I'm very ready.
Today's going to be a little bit of a change for me, people. Some of our older listeners may know this case very well, and some of our younger listeners maybe won't. And I asked Rachel just before we came on if she heard of it.
Which side of the fence am I on?
Well, you didn't hear of it, so you're obviously a younger listener, aren't you? Yes. Always a bonus. So let's go, shall we?
Let's go.
And if it's safe for you to do so, I'd like to relax. Close your eyes and picture the scene. Today I'd like to take us back to 1978, to the 19th of September 1978, and we're just outside of Stourbridge in the West Midlands. Now Stourbridge is a small market town, which these days has a population of around 63,000 people, and it's probably most well known as a glassmaking centre of the UK, the industry having started there in the 1600s, and while it is still ongoing, it's much reduced these days. For the sports fans out there, both Ronnie O'Sullivan and Jude Bellingham were born in Stourbridge. So that's the claim to fame.
What, so where's Stourbridge exactly?
It's in the same like roughly area as like Birmingham and that Dudley.
Producing fine sportsmen.
We're just outside of Stourbridge though today, to a small farm called Yew Tree Farm.
I've heard of Yew Tree Farm.
You've heard of Yew Tree because that's the name of the investigation into Jimmy Savile and all stuff.
Okay.
This is not linked to Jimmy Savile, though.
Good, good. I'm not sure that I would feel too comfortable having my young child in the room if we were going to do a case on that evil man.
But yeah, back in 1978, Yew Tree Farm was owned by two elderly cousins that lived together. And they were also described in most of the newspapers as a couple. So I'm not sure how cousins. That goes, but yeah. Yes.
I mean, it's legal.
It is legal.
So
their names were Mary Paul and Fred Jones. However, they were not home at the time. They had gone out for the day. And we're in the afternoon, and it's around 4:30 p.m. And a local schoolboy, 13-year-old Carl Bridgewater, was doing his regular paper round. He'd only been doing the paper round for around 2 months, and Yew Tree Farm was one of the last stops on his round, so his bag would have been almost empty by this point. And probably looking forward to getting home, to be fair. Carl, he was a helpful, friendly boy, and he'd grown to know Mary and Fred, the owners of Yew Tree Farm, and he knew that they were disabled and had trouble getting around. So what he would do, Rachel, he would let himself in the back door, obviously with their permission, he'd let himself in the back door of the farmhouse, and he'd leave the newspaper on a chair in the kitchen so they could get it a lot easier. And it wouldn't really matter if they were home or not, because they'd usually leave the back door unlocked anyway. So it was a Tuesday afternoon. Carl had finished school, and he'd almost finished his paper round when he let himself into the farmhouse of Yew Tree Farm to leave the newspaper on the kitchen chair, as I said, like he always did. Now, this would prove to be the last day he would do that, as most would accept that when he did this on that fateful day, he disturbed a burglary in progress. And the person or persons who had broken into the farmhouse, they took Carl into the living room, they sat him down on a sofa, and they shot him in the head with a shotgun, or in the face to be exact.
Oh my God. I didn't see that coming.
An hour later, at 5:30, a relative of the farmhouse owners found Carl dead, slumped upright on the sofa, with his newspaper bag still slung over his shoulder. So the problem the police had straight away, Rachel, was both a lack of a sensible motive and a lack of suspects. The farmhouse was quite isolated, so there'd be no chance of any neighbours witnessing anything. And even if anyone had heard a shotgun, it was a common noise to be found on farms at that time, so people wouldn't have thought twice about hearing it on a warm September afternoon. The murder, it instantly got the nation's attention. People were horrified, and they wanted to know why and who. 50 detectives were deployed on the case, with their initial task being to painstakingly search the land on the farm to see if they could find any clues. Now, it was widely accepted at the time, and ever since, actually, that it was a burglar or burglars who did it due to being disturbed. But the question is why? Because I don't know about what you think, Rachel, but it's a pretty extreme reaction to being caught breaking into a house. Because it's not the most severe of crimes, is it? Obviously, it's not a nice crime, but you're not going to get life for breaking into a house, are you? So
no, unless they disturbed something that was quite sinister. You know, like there was something that the property was being used for that Carl had interrupted. But that's absolutely like extreme. And I was going to wait for a pause in the story to be like, are we going to have some background as to what exactly Carl disturbed that day? Because yeah, getting shot in the face as well. It's just so inhumane for a child.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
I mean, it's inhumane for any person of any age, but especially a kid on a paper round. Like the epitome of innocence in the 70s.
Yes, yeah, definitely, yeah. Well, hopefully I can answer some questions for you as we go along. Detective Chief Superintendent Bob Stewart, who was leading the inquiry, would say to the press that the murder seemed completely unnecessary. In this part of his statement to the press, he gave an indication as to why he thought Carl was shot, and he said, "Every police officer on his inquiry is appalled by the viciousness of this unmerciful killing. It's possible, however, that Carl had to be silenced because he recognised someone." So you can see where they're going with that line of thinking, that they think he recognised one of the burglars, which is why they shot him.
Right, but recognizing one of the burglars to me would indicate that that was a member of his family, or somebody close to him, which makes it even worse because he's not some anonymous child. He's known to the burglars.
Well, you'd think that, yeah, and that's like, obviously, you could be talking about psychopath here, but yeah, you'd think that, yeah. So yeah, you can see where they're going with that line of thinking. And during the same police statement that occurred the following morning, the chief superintendent would also let the media know that they were looking for the owner of a blue estate style car, which is a Vauxhall Viva, by the way, that was seen near the house at the time of the murder, and they appealed for anyone with information to reach out to them. So Carl's father, Brian, he was 38, Rachel, when he was a pipe fitter, and he was approached on his doorstep by journalists shortly after his son's death. Now he was visibly upset. He was trying and not completely being successful in holding back the tears that obviously so wanted to stream down his face. And he would say this to the reporters: "These men are ruthless. They have no thought for other people at all. I just hope that anyone who is harbouring these killers comes forward with information, because these people are sadistic. If anyone could just come forward and give information to the police, this is all I ask. I know the police are doing all they can. We must leave it in their hands to sort out, but I'm a very bitter man. My wife is still in bed under sedation, and I have had to have treatment from my doctor." So it was obviously a very emotive statement, and I'm not sure I agree with trying to catch like the boy's father on the doorstep when he's obviously full of grief. But yeah, and he thinks he's killers. And he obviously would have talked to the police, or maybe the police at that time thought it was killers as well, like multiple rather than one.
Right.
Oh, that's what he said anyway. But the police were under immense pressure to solve this, both from within the police force and the public themselves. So just to give you an idea, the website that I use for archive newspapers, in the last 11 days of September and in October, so just over 40 days, there were over 300 separate articles about this murder in the British newspapers alone. So you can see, and it was also covered quite a lot in Ireland and around the world. So you can see that this had a huge amount of media attention to it. So yeah, the police wanted to solve this as quickly as possible, just because it was so brutal. And one of the first suspects that they had, Rachel, their lead suspect, in fact, was a man named Bert Spencer. He had a car that matched the general description of the one that was seen near the farm that day. He knew the farm, as the owners would used to let him shoot on their land, and he owned a shotgun. And for a few weeks, he was the number one suspect. When he was spoken to by the police, he denied that he knew Carl, although this was put into doubt at a later stage, as while nothing could be proven, it was shown that he would have likely been on the farm on at least a few occasions when Carl delivered a newspaper. Additionally, and this is probably a little bit more damning, he only lived 5 houses away from Carl. So even if he hadn't seen him at the farm on any occasions, it's very unlikely that he would never have seen Carl, given they live so close on the same street, and his children used to play in the street with Carl as well. He also denied owning any shotguns, which was a lie. And he also said that when he was walking in a nearby field with his niece, he found a piece of paper that implicated some of his colleagues in the murder. Now, at the time, he was an ambulance driver. So would you say that he seems like a pretty obvious suspect, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but an ambulance driver, again, I would imagine and picture in my head an upstanding member of the community, someone that's not going to, like, the last thing in the world, right? So I wouldn't imagine anyone that worked for the emergency services would, like, burgle a house. But to shoot a kid in the face,
yeah,
is, like, beyond comprehension for someone that would be used to turning up at traumatic scenes.
Yeah.
I'm going with, no, not a slam dunk on him.
Okay, well, Bert was discounted as a suspect, however, when Ambulance Secretary Barbara Ribold confirmed his alibi to the police that he was on duty the whole time before, and that he was in the hospital for the full day.
Well, I was going to say, on duty, you'd be partnered with somebody. You'd be accountable. Like, even in the 70s, you'd probably be tracked, wouldn't you? The vehicle, because they'd need to know where you were. So, yeah, that's a pretty solid alibi.
I think he did other tasks in his duties as well, because according to him and her, like, confirmation of alibi, he never actually left the hospital all day. So it was determined that it couldn't have been Bert who killed Carl. So in November of the same year, a string of burglaries were committed using a shotgun that the police thought could be linked to the murder of Carl. The first one was in Birmingham, which is not that far really from where the murder took place, relatively speaking. Three men carried out the robbery, with two of them paying attention to the safe and its contents. And this was in the Tesco's, by the way. The two of the men paying attention to the safe and its contents, and a third man keeping shop staff and customers quiet and also all in one place. And that third man had the aid of a shotgun that helped him, and he used threats of violence to keep them quiet and still. And at one point, the store manager tried to tackle the gunman, but was unsuccessful, with the criminal shooting the shotgun over the store manager's head to keep him in line. And 6 days later, on the 30th of November, three men robbed a retired 83-year-old farmer and his three sisters at an isolated farm at gunpoint with a shotgun. The farm was just 30 minutes from the scene of the murder. One stayed in the car, while the other two, without warning, ran into the house with their faces covered, waving the shotgun around and demanding money from the old couple who owned the farm. This time, no gun was fired, but they did hit one of the victims with the handle of the gun before stealing £300 and escaping. So following these two crimes, the police had a lead, and it wouldn't take them long to arrest Patrick Molloy, James Robinson, Michael Hickey, and Vincent Hickey, who were cousins. So the Tesco robbery, it was carried out by James Robinson, Michael Hickey, and the third man who was never identified or caught. The robbery of the old couple was carried out by James Robinson and the two Hickey cousins, with Vincent Hickey being the one who stayed in the car. So the way the police caught them, they managed to link the getaway car in the last robbery to Vincent Hickey, and he was then subsequently arrested. So Vincent was a 23-year-old small-time criminal from Birmingham. He had already been interviewed once in relation to Carl's death, but at the time was dismissed as not a viable suspect. And it didn't take long at all for him to begin admitting to the robbery, not the murder, the robbery. But then he later retracted that story. Now it's believed that he originally started talking to try to get bail or immunity. It's believed that he thought if he told him who was involved, he would get a lesser sentence, basically. And he told him originally that his cousin Michael Hickey, who was 16, and James Robinson, who was 43, and Patrick Molloy, who was 49, were also involved in the robbery. So James Robinson was the one who had bought and owned a shotgun using the two robberies. And in fact, both James and Vincent, both would end up admitting to the robbery at the farm. Not the robbery at Yew Tree Farm, but the robbery where they stole £300. But they wouldn't admit to the murder of Carl. Patrick Molloy was 49. He was a career criminal in Bregley, and he wasn't actually involved in either of the robberies, but he was held for 10 days. For the majority of these 10 days, he would deny any involvement in the murder of Carl, but would eventually change his story, and he made a statement saying that he had in fact gone to Yew Tree Farm with the other three. He said that he was upstairs in one of the bedrooms looking for antiques to steal when he heard a shot. He said he immediately ran downstairs, only to find Carl already dead on the sofa. So it's looking maybe it's a slam dunk. It's these four men that did it, isn't it, Rachel?
Yeah, but it has worried me that you said you pretty much came out with saying he thought if he came out with his story first that he'd get a lesser of a sentence. So is he admitting to something so that his crimes aren't?
No, this was Patrick Molloy. So the person who did that was Vincent Hickey.
Sorry.
And he was admitting to the crimes that they did do. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah, So on the back of that confession, all four men were charged with the murder of Carl Bridgewater. So please do bear in mind though, Rachel, the police had no evidence, nothing forensic, they had none of the vehicles used, they didn't have the murder weapon, and they didn't have any witnesses or any of the stolen antiques. In November of 1979, it would go to trial. Given there was no real evidence, it was largely dominated by the confession of Patrick Molloy, and they had confessions from older men, but it was largely dominated by the confession of Patrick Molloy. So all four men pleaded not guilty. But all four men were found guilty by a jury of their peers. Vincent Hickey and James Robinson would be found guilty of murder and sentenced to life with. So we have to remember that back then, the minimum terms for life were not used back then. So what they used to do back then, the judge would sentence a criminal and have a recommendation of how long they had to serve, not a minimum, just a total length. But then it used to be the Lord Chief Justice for youth criminals, and I believe the Home Secretary that actually set the term. So it's a little bit different how it works now. But Vincent Hickey and James Robinson will be found guilty of murder, and they'll be sentenced to life with a recommendation that they serve 25 years. And Michael Hickey, because he was under 17 at the time of the crime, he was 16, remember, he was ordered to be detained at Her Majesty's pleasure, with no time served to be recommended, because that was a decision of the Lord Justice. And Patrick Molloy, who made the confession, if you remember, he was found guilty of manslaughter, and he was jailed for 12 years.
Wow.
So this, though, is where it gets interesting, Rachel. After the convictions. Do you remember Patrick Molloy was held for 10 days in total?
Yes.
Well, it seems that in those 10 days, he was denied access to any type of legal representation, despite repeated requests. And he, after he was convicted, he would retract his statement, claiming that his confession had been beaten out of him by the police officers from the West Midlands Serious Crime Squad.
Wow. So,
despite him claiming this, nothing was acted on straight away. And Patrick would actually die in prison less than 2 years later after he collapsed while on the prison exercise yard. So he would never appeal his sentence because, unfortunately, he died in prison. A few months after his death, the remaining three men would appeal their sentence, with part of their appeal claiming that it was Bert Spencer. Do you remember the original ambulance driver?
Yeah.
That it was Bert Spencer who had killed Carl. So this first appeal, it was thrown out of court, with the appeal judge wholeheartedly rejecting the notion that anyone else other than those four men could have killed Carl. So, yeah. Speaking about Bert, let's go back to Bert, shall we, for a moment. Three months after the four men had been convicted, he shot and killed his friend, Hubert Wilkes, by shooting him in the head with a shotgun while he was sat on the sofa in a farmhouse that he owned, which was a mere minutes away from the one in which Carl died. Now, he admitted killing him.
You're joking me.
No, I'm not joking, you know. He admitted killing him, but he would refuse to give an explanation as to why he did it. So he would be found guilty of that murder and sentenced to serve 15 years in prison, which he did the full 15. Well, I think he actually did just 14 and a bit, but the full 15.
Doesn't that just completely, like, piss all over what I'd said about being an ambulance driver and having compassion and empathy and never shooting somebody in the face, let alone a child?
Yeah, kind of. I did think that, but I didn't want to interrupt you. He was released in 1995. So now, by now, Rachel, momentum around the innocence of the four men was slowly building, with interest in the case being increased in the public's eye when Michael Hickey, remember the 16-year-old at the time, obviously he's older now, he staged a three-month rooftop protest while in prison, claiming his innocence in the murder.
Oh, wow.
And he actually spelled on the rooftop. You can see it on, if you Google it, he actually spelled Bert Spencer's name on the rooftop of the person who did it. In 1987...
Wait, but Bert Spencer was in the hospital? on well, shift, wasn't he?
He still thinks he did it, yeah. In 1987, the then Home Secretary, Douglas Hurd, did refer the case back to the Court of Appeal, with one of the witnesses at the original trial coming forward and stating that they had made it up when they said Michael Hickey had confessed to them in a conversation that he had killed Carl. Additionally, Bert Spencer, so we know him by now, his original alibi would now claim, so Barbara, who gave him the original alibi, she would now claim that she couldn't be sure he had been absent from work at any point during the shift.
Oh my God.
Therefore casting doubt on his alibi. And it would actually come out at a much later date that she was extremely close to him and possibly in some type of extramarital relationship with him.
You're joking me.
Possibly, yes. So this appeal would last for a whole 8 weeks, which at the time, it was the longest appeal in British legal history. But ultimately, it was dismissed in January of 1989. The four men's supporters, so this is 10 years after they got convicted. The four men's supporters, though, they would not be beaten. With a dossier of evidence being sent to the Home Office in 1991, that included, amongst other things, evidence from a speech by an expert that Patrick's confession was fabricated, that it was made up. The Home Secretary was now Kenneth Clark, and he asked the Merseyside Police, so an independent police force, to conduct a new investigation into the case. So this was now, by now, this was now the sixth investigation to have occurred. And in early 1993, they concluded that nothing new had been uncovered to put the safety of the convictions in doubt. So rather unusually, though, Rachel, Timothy O'Malley, who was the foreman of the original trial, he actually came out in public and stated that he now thought the four men were innocent based on all the new evidence. That if he would have been on the, he would have been given that evidence in the original trial, they would have found all four men innocent.
Wow.
So there was a decision made to refer the case back to the Court of Appeal for another time. And this time it was based on two new bits of evidence. Firstly, there was a second set of prints found on Carl's bike, something which the police knew about all along, but it was never revealed at the first trial.
And secondly,
Patrick Molly had not been formally arrested when he made his original confession. So do you remember how the West Midlands Serious Crime Squad was involved in the investigation?
Yeah.
And they were the ones who obtained the confession from Patrick. So by now, 1993, the squad had been disbanded due to findings of incompetence and abuse of power, with dozens of cases failed due to malpractice of the squad, and also there were several high-profile convictions that were wrongful convictions, including the Birmingham Six, which is probably one of the most high-profile, if not the most high-profile cases, wrongful convictions in the UK.
Yep.
So obviously that makes you think, did they really beat the confession out of Patrick Molloy as he said they did as soon as he got convicted? One of the things claimed was that they made up the confession by Vincent Hickey and actually the other three men, over two men as well, in order to get Patrick to confess, which now, because now it turned out that they had proof and evidence that this serious crime squad did this several times in other cases. They made confessions up to put pressure on people to confess to things that they hadn't done. In July of 1996, it was finally referred to the Court of Appeal again. In 1997, some 18 years later, the Court of Appeal would examine the case. They decided to overturn all four convictions, releasing the three men who were still alive as free. So the appeal lasted for 5 weeks. Then they said that without the confession of Patrick Molloy, he would never have been convicted, and they could not now state that the confession was obtained legally. He had been denied legal representation. He had best been coerced into writing the confession, and at worst beaten, using several techniques, including the false confession from Vincent.
Wow.
They said that other evidence against James Robinson was as much that even without the confession being thrown out, they would still overturn the conviction. The evidence was concerns of his identification evidence, the treatment of his alibi, and the credibility of evidence against him. They stated that the evidence against Michael Hickey was such that a credible jury would never have convicted him. They said, they being the appeal court judges, that the unhappy conclusion that they had reached was that the criminal justice process had not operated fairly and the men did not receive a fair trial. And although they rejected allegations of a general conspiracy among police officers to pervert the course of justice, they said, and I'm quoting here, "This is another case of a miscarriage of justice, which is a matter of regret to this court." So the appeal judgment was damning, and it was 397 pages in length. So everyone, please forgive me if I don't read it all out in verbatim, but I've given you the main parts already. And the CPS, quite rightly so, they decided not to retry the three men. So it's widely now believed that Bert Spencer killed Carl, but the CPS declined to take him to court, stating a lack of evidence. Now, a book was published that heavily implicated Bert, and in 2016, the criminologist David Wilson, have you heard of him?
Yes.
He actually interviewed Bert Spencer for a Channel 4 documentary called Interview with a Murderer. Now, at the time of writing, I hadn't watched it, but I did actually watch this documentary last night because it's on All 4, if people want to watch it. And it's also on YouTube, so for those outside of the UK, I'll pop the YouTube link in the show notes.
And so, just to clarify, it's Craig, the Scottish guy, the criminologist, he's Scottish?
David, sorry. No, he's not Scottish, no. You're thinking of, I can't remember his name, but the other guy.
Okay, sorry.
So now I want to give you my thoughts on, I didn't want to watch it before I wrote the script to be like unduly influenced, but I watched it last night. So here are my thoughts on this. Oh. It's a fascinating watch. I recommend everyone goes to watch it. Not so much for what Bert Spencer says, because he does deny everything, obviously. He goes into detail. He gives reasons why he killed his friend, which he never did at the time. He said that his friend used to make spiked drug cocktails for the wives of the friends so they could all sleep with each other. And he lost it and blanked out when he agreed to do that. He offered Bert's wife one of these cocktails. Now, what's interesting is Bert's wife gave a different account of this. And Bert's wife said that at the time he was killed, his friend that is, they'd been talking about Carl's murder and they'd been talking about robbing farmhouses. And it also said that later evidence puts a Green Land Rover at the Yew Tree Farms, which Herbert owned. Now, they implied the documentary that possibly his friend was involved in it. And then when they started talking about Carl, he may have got worried that he was going to start admitting the truth to people. So he killed his friend. And that's why he then didn't give a reason as to why he killed him. This was all the implication. Obviously, Bert denied all of this.
Can I just interrupt there? What was his connection with the boy?
Well, they say that because they imply that the general theory is Carl walked into the house, recognized Bert.
An ambulance driver or an upstanding member of the community, or
they lived 5 doors down from him. He saw him. He played. Even Bert admitted that his kids played with Carl hundreds of times. But Bert said that he didn't recognize Carl when he got killed. But the theory is that he said, "Oh hi, Mr. Spencer," or something similar to that, and then Bert, even though he didn't recognize him, then just killed him because he recognized him. What else was there? Yeah, they took Bert to the house where he lived at when he was 5 doors down from Carl, and it's a set of terrace houses, so it's not a massive, like, you're talking 40, 50 feet away. They took him, well, Bert took them to the woman that gave him the alibi, and she basically confirmed that he didn't. I'm telling everyone what happened in the documentary here. Sorry, but it's really interesting.
Yeah, I'm actually going to go away and watch this, so maybe don't.
Okay, well, there's a lot more stuff. They also talk to Bert's wife at the time at the very end of the documentary, which is very interesting. I'm not going to tell you what she says, but I came away thinking that it's fascinating. I think Bert is a psychopath. Narcissist, definitely. Psychopath, most probably. David Wilson also thought maybe he was. I think that Bert did it, but we'll never
know. What's the documentary called?
Interview with a Murderer.
Okay.
It's on All4, and I'll pop the... Those not in the UK or Ireland, I'll pop the show... I'll pop the YouTube link into the show notes. It's really interesting. So, Rachel, there's a horrible miscarriage of justice, and Paul Carl never got his justice. His dad, a few years ago... Because his dad gave interviews at the time, but he hasn't really since. And a few years ago, he gave a rare interview. In it, he said that he hoped Carl would get justice, but that he never thought he would now. And he also said that a large part of him doesn't want the case to be reopened due to the hurt that it's just going to cause him and his wife. So what do you think of this one, Rachel? I know it took you on a turn that you wasn't expecting. So what do you think of this?
Oh, gosh. Just really sad that at the front and centre was a little boy, again, the epitome of innocence, losing his life, and a real botched job by the police over the years, and failure to like get to the truth in the first instance, with people potentially giving alibis that they shouldn't have, like, and causing like the miscarriage of justice. It's just unfair, isn't it? Like, so unfair that he was doing something so innocent and kind for the farmhouse owners in the first place. Unfair that he just happened to recognise the burglar. And then unfair on his family that, like you've just kind of said, they never really got justice. And his memory was probably tarnished by a case that's had so much bad press and did they, didn't they, who done it kind of speculation. How often do we see it with crimes where the victim is quite often forgotten because there is so much sensationalization over like who done it and their motives and theories? And I guess I'll go away and watch the documentary, so I'm not going to ask that question. But it's
the documentary is only about Bert. It's not really about...
Yeah, no, I was going to say, did his... did the lady who offered him the alibi, did she ever come up against any kind of, like...
No, because it was concluded that she just said that she couldn't be sure. It wasn't... I don't think anyone came to the conclusion that she'd said it, like, maliciously to deceive people.
Right.
If that makes sense.
If she couldn't be sure, but then she'd sworn. I'm gathering when you give a statement, you almost have to swear on oath, do you? The same way you would in court?
No.
Oh, okay. Fair enough then. I think I've said everything that...
I mean, it's an hour and 10, 15 minutes long, roughly. An hour and 20, bit if you watch it with the adverts, But yeah, it's really interesting.
I was going to say, I have a lot of time on my hands.
So what do you think of this one then, Rachel? I think you've just said everything you thought, haven't you? But any extra bit sad?
Yeah, it's incredibly sad. At the end of the day, a young boy lost his life, like, doing something that... You said at the top of the episode, didn't you? He's probably buzzing that he was close to the end of his paper round. I haven't met a kid that loves a paper round, like... It's usually your first job, isn't it? And it's the worst job because, it's just miserable, isn't it? Any weather, delivering papers, a heavy backpack and...
Probably, well, long distance as well.
Yeah, yeah. And you probably, in most cases, it's a thankless task because no one's home to say hi or thank you or anything. I'm conscious I'm babbling now. Sad, very sad case.
So I want to wrap this one up a little bit differently. I want to just put the focus back on Carl. Because we have to remember that, like you just said, Rachel, you've just said everything I'm about to say. We got to remember this young that a young boy's life was taken. So I'm going to play a very short clip of Carl's dad, Brian, talking about him. It's only a few seconds long, but I think it's a fitting place to end so we can just focus our attention back on Carl. So we're going to say goodbye now, and we'll see everyone next week. Have a great weekend, and yeah, listen to Brian's dad talk about what Carl was like.
Bye, guys. Thanks for listening.
As a cheerful boy, always going around nice and cheerful and helpful. You never saw him miserable, you know, he was always smiling and happy.